Welcome to the Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation podcast, highlighting key developments in rehabilitation research and practice. Upper limb dysfunction is a common and chronic impairment after stroke. Dr. Janice Daly and colleagues reported on a clinical trial comparing robotics, functional electrical stimulation, and motor learning methods for treating upper extremity dysfunction in the June 2015 issue of Archives. Dr. Daly is director of the Brain Rehabilitation Research Center of Excellence, Malcolm Randall Gainesville Department of Veteran Affairs Medical Center in Gainesville, Florida. She is also a professor in the Department of Neurology, College of Medicine at the University of Florida. I'd be interested to start by hearing the background to this piece of research. What was the prior journey that led you to wanting to compare these three treatment approaches?
From clinical practice, we already have a good knowledge base regarding some of the principles of motor learning and what is important for stroke survivors in relearning coordinated movements. One of those principles is practice of movements as close to normal as possible. Two technologies can assist us in this type of practice, and they are robotics and functional electrical stimulation. We use the term FES to refer to functional electrical stimulation. FES is simple to apply for wrist and finger flexion and extension practice, and it has the advantage of producing actual muscle contractions. For those reasons, we considered that FES would be an ideal practice assist technology for these severely impaired stroke survivors. However, for shoulder movements, FES would be much more complex to set up, due to the complicating factors of the interactions between the glenohumeral joint and scapula and the precision timing involved in muscle activation latencies for those movements. Therefore, we evaluated a shoulder-elbow robot for its advantages in assisting practice of the basic reach movements of shoulder and elbow. At the same time, we were very aware of the importance of other motor learning principles, which include attending to the task and integrating simple movement components into whole task practice. And so we were confident that both the robotics and FES interventions would require a period of motor learning practice without the technologies in order to consolidate newfound coordination into whole task practice. In comparing shoulder-elbow robotics to wrist-hand FES, we designed our control group to receive neither technology. That is, they received motor learning exclusively and without technologies.
There will be listeners who are not familiar with motor learning methods of treatment and also whose understanding of functional electrical stimulation and robotics-supported learning will be limited. Can you describe the basic mechanisms of each of these three treatment approaches?
Well, there are three ways that a robot can be used during practice of movements. First, the robot can completely perform the movement while the user passively allows the robot to move the limb. Or second, one can actively perform the movement, overriding the robot assistance. Third, the robot user can partially perform the movement while the robot simultaneously assists somewhat. When the robot moves the limb, joint receptors can send affective signals to the brain with information regarding joint position. An advantage of shoulder-elbow robotics practice is that the robot can support the forearm and the hand, both of which are immobilized, and it provides a movement guide. A disadvantage of robotics is that it does not require a muscle contraction during practice. Rather, it simply allows the movement. That is, the practice session might be completely passive. In contrast, the functional electrical stimulation, or FES, can be used to activate muscles at specific levels of force production and at specific timings. FES can be finely titrated and reduced as the individual regains volitional control. During FES use, affective signals from both joint receptors and muscle receptors are sent to the brain with information regarding joint position, muscle length, muscle tension, and the relative timings of the muscle activations across the muscles. Our third intervention, motor learning, is familiar to all of us because we've all learned skilled motor tasks. Examples might be typing on an iPhone, a computer, learning a sport, dancing. Principles of motor learning include progressively practicing a more and more normal or more and more highly skilled movement, attending to the task, that is not daydreaming or not thinking of something else. And then finally, practicing variations of the skills movement so that it can be executed under varying situations.
Coming into the study, what were your expectations regarding the likely findings from this three-way comparison?
We expected to find no difference between the three treatments for the primary functional task performance measure of whole arm complex tasks or for the secondary measure of whole arm coordination. We did, however, expect that the shoulder elbow robotics treatment group would perform better than the other groups on the AMAT shoulder elbow subscale. And we expected that the wrist hand FES treatment group would perform better than other groups on the AMAT wrist hand subscale. And we expected similar results for the Fugelmeier shoulder elbow and Fugelmeier wrist hand coordination subscale. Instead, we found not only dramatic results for all three groups, but no group difference on any measure. Some might think that a larger sample size might show a group difference. But another explanation could be that there was a daily portion of the session that included motor learning with no technologies. So, this part of the training, the motor learning without technologies, might have been the most important aspect of training, and it was common to all three groups.
Now, this therapy wasn't an hour a week. It was intensive. Can you describe the schedule these participants were on?
The patient treatment schedule was from 9 a.m. to noon, followed by a one-hour lunch break, and then the treatment began again at 1 and lasted until 3 for a total of 5 hours per day, and it was given for 5 days per week. For lunch, patients were provided a quiet room with a table where they brought their lunch, and some left the clinic for a break elsewhere.
It sounds like an incredibly intensive treatment regimen. Is that a typical treatment regimen for participants or people who are receiving a clinical service of this kind, or is this more intensive than usual?
This kind of a treatment protocol is not offered in current clinical standard practice. And the participants were tired at the end of the day. Motor learning required close attention on their part, a lot of patience and much persistence. But throughout the day, of course, they had multiple breaks and snacks at any time. For every session, they were in a group of three patients with one therapist, and they were all in the same room and often working at the very same large table. They offered each other a lot of encouragement and jokes and funny reminders to stay on task. There was a lot of good energy and hope for some recovery.
On the basis of your data, what could you conclude about the effectiveness of the interventions?
Well, treatment effectiveness for all three groups was greater than any other reported study of treatment for moderate to severely impaired chronic stroke survivors. Treatment effectiveness was measured according to the Fugelmeier Upper Limb Coordination Scale, and treatment effectiveness was also measured according to the AMAT Functional Score. And the AMAT is a test that's based on 13 complex tasks. I would like to emphasize that the AMAT is a homogeneous functional task scale in that there are not items in the AMAT that are at the impairment level, such as flex your elbow or open or close your hand. Rather, the entire AMAT score is based on performance of these functional, complex functional tasks. So according to the AMAT, treatment effectiveness was unequivocally based on a functional level according to the AMAT.
It was encouraging to see a health economics analysis in the paper. Can you summarize the conclusions there?
The protocol cost for the robotics treatment group was $5,686, and for the FES group was $4,604. For the motor learning, that is the no technologies group, the cost was $4,570. The motor learning group and the FES group were comparable to each other in cost, and both of these groups were less expensive than the robotics group by approximately $1,000.
If someone wants to take this further forward into their clinical service, how could they go about examining implementing these techniques? Are there specific resources you'd point them towards?
There are a number of important aspects to this type of treatment, and I can describe a few of them right now. First of all, it's important to ensure that the FES stimuli are within comfort of the patient. Otherwise, motor learning of complex coordination tasks is difficult and may not occur at all. Second, after FES or robotics intervention, it's important to provide a motor learning session without the technology so that component practice is integrated into whole task performance practice. Third point, it's important to accurately assess a patient's coordination impairment for each task and for each component of that task. It's critical to guide practice and target practice at the exact challenge point for that patient. for that task, for that component of the task. If the practice is too easy, no learning will occur. If the task is too difficult, practice will not be conducted with enough repetitions or in a way that is progressing toward normal movement. If there's a lack of progression toward normal movement, there's a danger of continually and further ingraining discoordinated movements. I can think of two potential resources. First, a physical therapist who is neurorehabilitation certified specialist, that is an NCS, and who also specializes in motor learning. I could say that an NCS is a certification for a physical therapist that is conferred only after rigorous training, testing, and experience. A second resource that I could name is that there's another open access 9-page publication available that describes some of the detail of this type of motor learning for stroke survivors. It is for the lower extremity, but the motor learning principles and practice are the same. This publication can be located in the Journal of Rehabilitation Research and Development, which is an open access journal, or one could look in PubMed under 2010 Daily, D-A-L-Y. This is published as an editorial article in 2012, volume 49, issue 8, pages Roman numeral 19 through 28.
I'm Duncan Babbage, Associate Professor in Rehabilitation in the School of Clinical Sciences at Auckland University of Technology and Director of AUT's Centre for eHealth. The producer for this episode was Juliet Drown. You can access the paper discussed in this podcast in the June 2015 issue of Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at archives-pmr.org. For information about the American Congress of Rehabilitation Medicine, the parent organization of Archives, visit acrm.org.